Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. makes its position clear to North Korea.
But all options are on the table.
Off limits, the White House visitors log will not be made public. A referendum election in Turkey may not have been free and fair. Also ahead, what may be the most eco-friendly shoes in the world? It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Vice President Mike Pence will head to Japan today, the next stop on his 10-day four-nation trip that will include Indonesia and Australia. His first stop was South Korea on the heels of a failed missile launch by North Korea. Pence on Monday issued a strong warning that President Donald Trump will use military force if needed to deal with Kim Jong-un's government's escalating nuclear threat. Speaking from the Korean demilitarized zone, Pence said no options are off the table.
For more than two decades, the United States and our allies have worked to peacefully dismantle North Korea's nuclear program and alleviate the suffering of their people. But at every step of the way, North Korea answered our overtures with willful deception, broken promises, and nuclear and missile tests. The era of strategic patience is over.
The vice president is aiming to reinforce the U.S. commitment to allies in this increasingly volatile region. He's also hoping to build international support for increasing pressure on the North to end its nuclear and ballistic missile development programs. Meanwhile, in New York, North Korea's deputy U.N. ambassador Kim In-ryong held a hastily called news conference threatening actions to the U.S. warnings.
It has been created a dangerous situation in which the thermonuclear war may break out at any moment on the peninsula and pose a serious threat to the world peace and security, to say nothing of those of the Northeast Asia.
Well, joining me now for analysis on this intensifying situation is military analyst Rebecca Grant, president of the IRIS Independent Research Group. Thanks so much for being with us. So, what does the vice president mean when he mentioned the end of the era of strategic patience?
Strategic patience was a Obama administration policy, and actually Secretary of State Rex Tillerson announced a month ago that the era of strategic patience was over. So I think we're kind of waiting to see what it means, but we've already seen some actions that back that up, the most important one being open and frequent discussions now between Trump and China's Xi Jinping. Also very important is Pence's trip to the region, where he's clearly having important private conversations with the South Korean leadership, and he'll go on to talk to other Asian allies. In those conversations, Pence and the South Korean leadership can share intelligence. They can check in on where military forces are. South Korea can give their private view of what's really going on in the North politically. Is Kim Jong-un still facing some internal instability problems? So Pence's visit is very well timed. Then, of course, we've seen several shaping military moves. The USS Vinson strike group, the aircraft carrier, not going to Australia for the war game, but they're heading up to patrol stations around North Korea. We've seen our air forces in South Korea doing a show of force, and I'm sure our army forces there are ready too. So put all that together, we are now in an era where we're really looking for China to make a move, and we're going to be right there to back it up. And Trump says if China doesn't do something, the alliance will.
So former U.S. ambassador to North Korea Christopher Hill has made some statements saying that a superpower can't afford to bluff. The vice president said that North Korea would be wise not to basically test the resolve of this administration. Very tough talk coming out of this White House. Do you believe that they will follow through, and how dangerous and delicate of a situation are we in right now?
There are two important questions. Will they follow through? Absolutely. But let's put it in context. This is a very important chess game, but there are a lot of players on the board, our allies, China, us, North Korea, naturally. But we have seen everyone from the administration take a very firm line. They're not giving us a lot of detail, but as our National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, said, we're looking at all the possible military options. So I think the fact is that we're seeing military action now with a movement of forces. There can be military action that does not necessarily mean all-out war. But what we do see is this White House is willing to brandish military forces, do the type of shaping military operations to prove that they really mean it on the policy front. And I think Pence is reinforcing that. He's saying, you would not be smart to test this. Looking back, too, at the question of North Korea's missiles, one of our admirals who was commander of Northern Command said a couple years ago, he said, hey, if they launch a missile, we are going to knock it down. So we do have missile defenses in place, interceptors up in Alaska. We have a lot of theater missile defenses, which means on our Navy ships in the region, and then we have a new missile defense system going into South Korea itself. So the ring is really closing on Kim Jong-un, and I see the Trump White House using a pretty good opportunity with China being willing to help out, try to put pressure on that whole situation. And as they keep saying, Secretary Mattis put it best, North Korea has got to change its behavior.
Forget the nuclear part. Their conventional military, which is pretty large, could they potentially do quite a bit of damage to South Korea?
The history of the standoff is one of incredible restraint by North Korea, the complete opposite of their rhetoric. When they actually use military forces in these little skirmishes, they really, really play it safe and very conservatively. So the history is that the skirmishes do stay contained. The other big relevant point is South Korea, joined by our U.S. forces, have a truly formidable military presence there on the Korean Peninsula. And military sources that I've talked to over the past week have just said with a very stony face, we are ready.
And lastly, North Korea, in response to what's been coming from the White House, has made a statement saying that nuclear war could erupt at any moment. Is that more rhetoric, or is this man willing to go to that extreme? And how worried should we be?
You never know, but clearly that's rhetoric. This is an ambassador at the UN making this point because this is from, in a way, it's from a position of weakness. They see the ring closing around them, especially with the new level of communication between Washington and Beijing. Things are closing in. The Trump administration is obviously serious. How worried should we be? Look, we have to take this seriously. There's no question. But keep in mind, we do have the missile defenses. And I think most of all, we can't let this continue as it has for so many years. So I think what we see now is the more that Kim Jong-un decides to test and push it, these are going to start to be liabilities. We've sloughed them off a little bit in the past, but now we're really taking them seriously. And I think that's what the policy, the end of strategic patience, really, really means.
All right. Rebecca Grant, president of the IRIS Independent Research, thank you so much for your perspective. And in Turkey, angry protesters took to the streets to protest an election referendum that gives President Tayyip Erdogan the ability to stay in power until 2029 if he chooses.
Well, actually, we are protesting today because the results announced by government is not the real one, because actually
international monitors have questioned the fairness of Sunday's referendum, saying it was contested on an uneven playing field. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Turkey expert Aslam Goner at the City University of New York on Staten Island if she believes there's evidence that the count really was unfair.
There is. There definitely is. There's, there are several thousands of reportings of voting fraud, which is the oppositional party, the Republican People's Party, as well as the People's Democratic Party. They're both raising the voices on this. And to start with, even prior to the elections, that there was definitely not a fair campaign. As you might know, Turkey entered this election. It was under the extraordinary law situation that was declared after the attempted coup. last summer, so there was already the independent media in Turkey has been all but silenced, basically, with over 160 media outlets and publishing houses closed down since the coup attempt in July 2016. And journalists, over 120 journalists and media workers are currently jailed pending trial. And so the condition that the elections took place were already not fair. I mean, there was basically no representation of the No campaign on the mainstream media. And maybe most importantly, the People's Democracy Party, the HDP, their leaders and 11 members of the parliament were jailed. So there was, they had no... no condition of doing their leading their campaign and making their campaign visible. And there were several reports of intimidation of opposition members, and they were shot or beaten while they were by unknown persons while they were trying to put up signs for the No campaign. There are several threats on people who were protesting or doing the No, leading the No campaign prior to the referendum.
Aslam, will the concerns of the opposition be addressed at all or not?
No, right now they're not. During the election itself, something that was very appalling happened. So what happened was, in addition to these this situation of fear and intimidation that I mentioned, people were even afraid to say that they were going to vote no because, you know, 100,000 civil servants were fired from their jobs or were basically after the coup d'etat. So this was the extraordinary low situation, which felt people felt very threatened. But on top of all this, and also the Kurdish provinces, basically, there was the military and the police present near the voting stalls, which creates an immense threat in these regions that were already crushed by the Turkish military. There were around 500,000 displaced people in these regions. And even those who could make it to voting realized the military and the police were present, and the party, the observers from the opposition parties in some cases were threatened to leave, you know, which is illegal. So in addition to these, there was something major that happened while the counting of the vote started. This was the Supreme Election Board that regulates the elections in Turkey. They unexpectedly decided to accept ballots without the official seals. This was after the voting process was over. One AKP representative suggested to count in those votes, which were supposed to be null because basically there's no way to prove that they are actual votes. They could easily be fraud. So prior to this election, these votes that did not have the official seals from the Supreme Election Board were considered null. They were not counted. But they somehow got this decision, took the decision that unless proven that it was brought from outside, which there's no way of proving that, then these votes counted. And these are around, although the Supreme Election Board says that they don't know how many, the opposition party expects that there are around 1.5 to 2 million votes like this.
That's Aslam Goner, professor of sociology and anthropology at the City University of New York. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Kenyans sweep the titles in the 121st Boston Marathon. Donald Trump greets children and families at the annual Easter egg roll. Finding the Chibok girls may take years, according to a new general warning. And Pope, or former Pope Benedict, celebrates his 90th birthday. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump's administration said Friday that it would not disclose the names of people who have visited the White House, ending a policy of President Barack Obama's that was designed to promote transparency. Monday, during the daily press briefing, Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked about it by reporters.
We're following the same policy that every administration from the beginning of time has used with respect to visitors log. We will comply with both the Federal Records Act and the Presidential Records Act as stated by law.
The president object to people knowing who is coming in the White House?
Well, it's not a question of objecting. It's about following the law. We're following the law as both the Presidential Records Act and the Federal Records Act prescribe it. So it's the same policy that every administration had up until the Obama administration. And frankly, the faux attempt that the Obama administration put out where they would scrub who they didn't want put out didn't serve anyone well.
A coalition of three watchdog groups sued in federal court this week to try to compel the release of the visitor logs. My next guest says legal problems could continue to plague the administration's agenda. Joining me now is attorney James Goodnow. Now, are you talking about actual lawsuits?
When Donald Trump assumed office, he had a record number of lawsuits that any president has ever faced in history. He was looking at upwards of 75 lawsuits on day one. Within the first 2 weeks of the administration, there were an additional 50 lawsuits that were filed. And Donald Trump has to deal with these cases. He can't just brush them aside. And that's according to the United States Supreme Court. In the past, presidents have argued that they have immunity from lawsuits. And that's partially true. What the Supreme Court has said is that if you are sued for an official act as president, you do, in fact, have immunity. If Donald Trump is sued in his individual capacity for making a decision, as an example, to take military action somewhere, there would be immunity for that. What he doesn't have immunity for, however, is anything that is, one, unofficial, not related to his duties as president, or two, anything that happened before he took office. A lot of these lawsuits, if not the majority of them, are related to actions that Donald Trump took before he started as president and for actions that are unrelated to his duties as president. So now what's happening is the Trump administration and Donald Trump specifically is trying to stop these lawsuits, and he's trying to question the law and say, well, that law isn't exactly right, or we need to look at this law differently because I should have immunity because these lawsuits will stop me from running the country. Well, we don't know how the courts are going to rule, but we have a pretty good indication of this. If you go back to 1997, when Bill Clinton was president, there was a case that was decided on this. Clinton, Bill Clinton v. Jones, Paula Jones. And that's where the Supreme Court said, no, you can be sued, and those lawsuits will not be stopped because of the presidency, and those lawsuits will not even be delayed. That's a significant point. In that case, President Bill Clinton was saying, well, if the suit's going forward, let's at least deal with it once I'm out of office. And to that, the court said no. Here, likely, although President Trump is trying to stop these lawsuits, likely that case, that Clinton versus Jones case, will come back and bite him, and the courts will say, no, we're not going to stop these. So what does that mean? That means that President Trump will be dealing with lawsuits, likely offering testimony in those cases in the form of deposition testimony, perhaps even going to court in some of these. And I think the risk for the Trump administration is not just dealing with those lawsuits. It's dealing with the information that will come out of them. It's dealing with testimony that will surface through what we call in the law the discovery process, the exchange of information, the asking of questions. Those pieces of information certainly could have political ramifications when they get into the public eye.
Will the public have access to these hearings? How will they get the information as to what's going on? And if there are that many of them, how does a person keep track of that many legal issues and run a country?
You keep track of all of these legal issues with the help of a lot of lawyers that will deal with all of these different cases. He has the ability to settle these lawsuits as well and pay out money. We saw that as recently as the Trump University settlement, where President Trump paid out $25 million to settle fraud claims. The question of whether or not the information will become public, there are certain parts of a litigation case that are public. When a complaint, the document that starts a lawsuit, is filed, That's available to the public. There are certain motions that are filed with the court that are public. Now, there are ways where pieces of that can be filed under seal. We call that if a judge looks at it and says, oh, this is so sensitive and so damaging, we can't release it. But a lot of information will come out about these cases.
You've written that this could be the unraveling of the presidency. How so?
Well, all of this is on a spectrum. We know right now Donald Trump is juggling a lot, and he certainly has dealt with lawsuits in the past. The worst case scenario for the White House, which admittedly is an unlikely one, but if some bit of information comes out of these underlying lawsuits that leads to greater concern within the public, likely through the media, that then leads to a bigger ramifications that could, as an example, lead to impeachment. Go back to President Clinton. That's precisely what happened. We know that when Paula Jones brought this sexual harassment claim, that's the case that went up to the Supreme Court, and it was ultimately the President Clinton's testimony related to these sexual harassment claims that led to his impeachment. So it's not like this is unprecedented. Now, in that case, of course, Bill Clinton remained in office. He wasn't convicted in the Senate. There weren't the votes for that. But you could see something like that happen. If there's some bit of information that's unearthed through these lawsuits, certainly you would see Democrats likely using that in efforts potentially to try and, you could imagine, impeach the president. How likely is that? It's very difficult to say. We don't know what information is out there, and we don't know what the political climate will be when that happens. But for something that extraordinary to happen is not unprecedented.
That's Attorney James Goodnow. Thank you so much for your perspective. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition, continuing. While each day millions of Americans drink purified water and other beverages from disposable plastic bottles, more than 60 million of those bottles are dumped into landfills or burned in incinerators daily. But a couple of American entrepreneurs are putting some of them to good use by recycling them into shoes. VOA's Deborah Block has more.
These may be the world's most eco-friendly manufactured shoes. A San Francisco startup is using recycled plastic water bottles to create fashionable women's footwear called Rothy's.
We sterilize those bottles, hot wash them, they get chipped into flake, and then they're extruded into a very soft filament fiber.
Those fibers are placed into a 3D knitting machine designed to minimize waste during the shoe assembly. Then, the knitted fabric and insole are attached to the shoe's outer sole, made from responsibly sourced no-carbon rubber. Rothy's are sold online. After American actress Gwyneth Paltrow discovered them last year, the demand for the shoes grew.
We're not going to run out of water bottles anytime soon, so we've got an infinite supply of material, and I think that bodes well for our future.
Once the environmentally friendly shoes wear out, they can be returned free of charge to a company that uses the recycled materials to turn them into other products. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study concerning string theory was recently released by mechanical engineers at the University of California, Berkeley. Before you think this concerns a quantum or particle physics hypothesis, this study concerns shoestrings. specifically why our shoelaces manage to keep getting untied. They found out that the failure of a shoelace knot takes place in just a few seconds and is set off by a series of complex force reactions that act like an invisible hand. These forces loosen the knot and then tug on the free ends of the laces until they become undone. While tying shoelaces as tightly as possible will still result in the knot becoming untied eventually, doing so at least will give you more time before you have to stop and retie your shoes compared to laces tied loosely. I give my shoelaces a double bow to keep them secure. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced this month a new grant to support the work of the National Election Committee, or NEC, to administer Cambodia's 2017 and 2018 elections. The two-year, $1.8 million Cambodia Election Management Project, awarded to the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, will help the NEC implement voter education campaigns, strengthen its election dispute resolution processes, and enhance its ability to identify and mitigate weaknesses in the country's electoral system. This program follows previous USAID support for the National Election Committee, which included an internal capacity assessment, training on election administration, and assistance to produce a set of public service announcements about voter registration. The new grant will help ensure the NEC follows through on its commitment to effectively administer elections and advance meaningful electoral reform through the commune elections in 2017 and national elections in 2018. USAID was founded in 1961 by President John F. Kennedy and serves as the lead agency of the U.S. government for foreign assistance. Since 1992, USAID has invested approximately $1 billion towards Cambodia's development. The International Foundation for Electoral Systems supports citizens' rights to participate in free and fair elections. Its independent expertise strengthens electoral systems and builds local capacity to deliver sustainable solutions. Since 1987, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems has worked in over 145 countries, from developing democracies to mature democracies. Electoral participation is the foundation of a healthy democracy, said U.S. Ambassador to Cambodia, William Haidt. We look forward to working with the National Election Committee, civil society, and political parties to continue to strengthen democracy in Cambodia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.